I'm Tom Kuser. This is The Full Story. The $600 weekly supplemental checks for workers who were laid off because of the COVID-19 shutdown is set to expire very soon if Congress fails to extend the program. And just yesterday, the U.S. Department of Labor reported another 1.4 million Americans filed for first-time unemployment benefits last week. The COVID-19 pandemic is taking its toll on household economies all over the country. Let's take a closer look at how they're holding up in our region. First off, the numbers. Andy Condon, the director of the Office of Research and Information at the Connecticut Department of Labor, joins us on the phone. Hello, Mr. Condon.
Hello. How are you?
Pretty well. Thank you very much. Can you tell us what are the newest employment numbers for Connecticut?
Well, Connecticut lost 291,000 jobs in March and April of this year, just a couple of short months ago. Nothing like that has been seen in our recorded history. Since that, in May and June, we have started a recovery of those jobs. So through May and June, we have gained back about 101,700 jobs, or 35% of what we lost due to the pandemic. The latest numbers we got, we gained 78,000 jobs in June over the prior month in May. The areas where we lost the most jobs were in leisure and hospitality, where we lost 50% of the jobs that are out there, 72,000. Trade, transportation, utilities, primarily retail trade, we lost 50,000 jobs. Education and health, we lost 45,000 jobs. And professional and business services, we lost 26. In fact, every industry sector we look at lost jobs, but these were the major losses.
If you look at the past 4 months during the pandemic, how have the numbers changed as far as employment goes? Do you see a trend? Things are reopening now, we know, and Connecticut and New York, for that matter, are much closer to reopening many areas of the economy than the rest of the country. What sort of a trend are you seeing with those numbers over the past 4 months?
Well, we saw an unprecedented drop. You know, we've entered a recession unlike anything we've seen before in its cause and its suddenness. So we saw tremendous losses in March and April and almost unprecedented gains in May and June. But that has to be put into the perspective of how many jobs we've lost. So, you know, we saw a loss of nearly 300,000, 290,000 jobs, and we've seen 100,000 of them come back. It's quite a roller coaster. We believe we will see the trend of upward growth in recovery of jobs. How quickly that happens depends on how successful our reopening efforts are.
You mentioned the industry sectors that were most affected by the shutdown. I'm wondering, does that translate into regions of the state? Which parts of the state would you say saw the highest unemployment numbers?
Well, in general, all parts of the state were injured. The two largest geographic regions were the Southeast and Southwest. The Stamford area and in the Northeast, the New London area. Southeast, excuse me.
And in terms of recovery, are you seeing recovery in those parts of the states likewise being the strongest right now because the losses were the greatest there?
Actually, I'm not sure I can answer that yet, but what I can answer is the recovery appears to be the reverse of the losses. That is, we're seeing the most recovery in jobs in those industries that were hurt the worst.
I'm wondering, too, about companies or especially small businesses that simply will not be reopening once this is over. Do you have any numbers that that reflect unemployment connected with perhaps permanent job loss due to especially small businesses just not being able to open their doors again?
Unfortunately, the data we collect doesn't let us know in real time whether these businesses will reopen or not. We have a lot of most of our data is based on unemployment insurance reports of employment by businesses every quarter, and we're getting a lot of businesses reporting zero employment. What we don't know yet is if that's temporary and we'll come back as we are able to reopen the economy, or whether some of those are permanently lost.
How do the Connecticut numbers compare with other states, perhaps New York being the closest state with a recovery that's underway, perhaps somewhat similar to ours, and even to parts of the country now that are experiencing the first wave to a large degree?
Yeah, we behaved, if not in number, in direction, quite similar to New York. The virus impacted us approximately at the same time and approximately at the same level, and that's one of the reasons why the southwest part of the state bordering the New York metropolitan area was one of the worst hit. It seems the impact on jobs and the economy, it depends on when states and cities saw the buildup of the virus and how they dealt with it. So I think we're seeing in the Northeast that we saw the damage done early, and the response to it was strong in terms of shutting down the economies and keeping people at home. So we are seeing in the Northeast the beginnings of recovery now. We hope that's sustainable. And yet in the South and the West, we're seeing a repeat of what we saw here, but several weeks later.
Do the numbers at all give you a clue as to how sustainable the recovery is? Is there any way to, perhaps look ahead, or do the numbers simply tell you what's been happening?
Well, perhaps a bit of both. I mean, we've regained a third of the jobs that were shut down for public safety reasons. And having done that, we don't appear in Connecticut to be seeing at this point in time any return in the growth rates of spread of the virus. We seem to have flattened. We haven't obviously eliminated it yet, but we seem to have flattened. That's encouraging. I think whether that continues is going to be how carefully and how deliberately we conduct the reopening.
This pandemic and the shutdown, if not unique, certainly unusual for Connecticut, well, for the country and the world, I guess we could say. I'm wondering, as far as the way you collect and analyze data, has this experience informed any need for change in the way you bring in this data and analyze it?
That's interesting. Our office works most closely with the U.S. Department of Labor, Bureau of Labor Statistics. We work in partnership with them to collect both the payroll job survey estimates we publish every month and the residential unemployment data. And those are largely survey-based, and they were challenged, to say the least, by the suddenness of the shutdown, both in terms of being able to contact businesses and individuals as to their status, and in terms of the infrastructure we use for collecting information. In the case of the unemployment statistics, it has had a lasting impact on for a few months now on the quality of that data. The payroll job survey data seems to have maintained its quality and accuracy, but we've seen challenges with the unemployment data.
Mr. Condon, thank you so much for your time. I'm sure we'll be in touch in the near future to get an update on the numbers, the employment numbers in Connecticut.
Very good. Pleased to talk to you.
Andy Condon is the director of the Office of Research and Information at the Connecticut Department of Labor. On Long Island, the number of people employed in private sector jobs went up by more than 40,000 in May and by 71,800 in June. The number of jobs lost once the state went into the shutdown were significant, 7,800 in March and 252,000 in April. Right now, the total number of private sector jobs on Long Island as of June 2020 stands at 980,500. That's a drop of more than 194,000 jobs from last year at this time. The COVID-19 pandemic has marred the economic prospects of immigrant communities on Long Island, especially people that rely on seasonal summer work to pay bills throughout the entire year. A group that has refocused its efforts to respond quickly to this growing crisis is Organización Latino Americana of Eastern Long Island, or OLA. Minerva Perez is the executive director, and she joins us on the phone. Hello. Thanks for taking time today.
Good afternoon, Tom. Thank you.
Tell us about the Latino immigrant people who live on Eastern Long Island. They're families with children, and they live there all year round, right?
Yes, we have a population on our east end of Long Island that is about 20 to 25%, and this also makes up the majority of our workforce out here on the east end of Long Island. And as most people know out here, it takes a lot to run a place like this. It is beautiful. It is a seasonal community, but it's also a year-round community, and we're happy and very lucky to have the members, the Latino members of our community out here living year-round.
Could you tell me what the pandemic has done to their lives?
Sure. Well, given the workforce out here that is not able to work from home, they're not able to essentially call in sick and still be able to meet the payments for their rent, it put people in a situation that that was a little bit more dangerous. So when folks came out here to sort of escape the city, when they came out here to just sort of hunker down, it also brings with that sort of the demands that you would expect, if that means restaurants, grocery stores, things that you might need to live out here and run your home and run this community. It means a workforce, and that workforce is predominantly Latino, and it meant that people were going to work because they needed to, pay their own rent, but it also meant that their risk was going up. And at a certain point, when we were working with the hospital out here, the Stony Brook Southampton Hospital, we learned that there were about 75% of the patients with COVID were Latino. And that's something that, you know, it's a sad situation because you would expect that to happen in a workforce, but what's unfortunate is that many of our Latino community members are not able to live in situations that that they can bounce back from having COVID. Even if they're able to bounce back physically, what does that mean in terms of the rest of their family? They might be living with an elderly parent. They might be living with children. So then how are they managing that? And there's not an infrastructure, or there's not enough attention put on how we make sure that this workforce that we value and we need so much, that we're also valuing them when they are at their greatest crisis.
Given the needs prompted by this pandemic, unique situation certainly, what services is OLA providing?
Well, we had never done this before, but we realized that food people were having terrible food crises, and these were families that had never asked for help before in the past, so they were not acquainted with food pantries that do exist that were also overburdened, but they weren't even acquainted with those kinds of systems. So we connected them, and in many cases, families were homebound. They were homebound for a variety of reasons, and so we had to start a service with volunteers shopping for food in grocery stores and bringing that food to the doorstep of the families that could not get to a pantry or a food store otherwise. And so we did a lot of that. At a certain point, we had quite a number of families, just under 100 families. But we started getting phone calls from far and wide beyond the East End region that we mainly serve. And then we began working with the county to make sure that a hotline was established that would be able to meet the need of the homebound and hungry within the full county of Suffolk. And that is happening right now with a 311 number.
What do you find people need most right now?
People are very eager to not have any support. They want to be working. I think right now people need access to health care in a way to make sure that they are being tested and that they are being tested for antibodies as well, that they do not have to fear going to the hospital or going to the doctor, that they don't have to fear a hospital bill or don't have to fear someone collecting data and using it for the wrong means. We need people to have full access to the same things that everyone else has. So if that means transportation to get to a doctor, if that means access to a doctor, if it means access to mental and emotional health support for yourself and your family when this level of isolation that has been thrust upon all of us across our country is something that some families don't have any sort of professional or licensed mental health support. And that's doing terrible things to our community, especially our adolescents and their families.
That I guess that begs the question, are people getting access to health services regardless of their status, of their legal status?
It's a tricky thing. People are very afraid of bills as much as they are afraid of information going, you know, in the wrong direction. There's enough that's coming from our White House right now that lends fear to almost every one of these conversations that we're having, whether it be education, whether it be census, whether it be health care, whether it be safety and security and access to protection from law enforcement. There are a number of these just basic life needs that we have that are affected by these other conversations that are very real. They're not imagined or fabricated fears. They're real and they're valid.
So the pandemic is, you would say, heightening concern beyond normal times, if I could use that word, about deportation of people who don't have documentation.
Yes, I mean, we still have a public charge rule in effect that continues to confound people because in some cases you can still get services, especially for your child, whether that be health services or a free or reduced price lunch. There are some things that you can get, but there are certain aspects of reaching out for help that would then put you in a very bad situation when you are applying for your green card status. So these get in the way, and they get in the way. There's, you know, there's a reason why they're being said and being done, because they're meant to get in the way. But it is stopping, you know, our community that is a very healthy, peaceful community generally. It's stopping our community from moving forward, from being as healthy as it can be on a very baseline kind of level. And that's a problem. And it's a problem for everyone. It's not a Latino problem. It's an East End problem. It's across the board. It's a problem.
There have been predictions that due to the loss of some federal support, federal programs, $600 a week, unemployment compensation, which is another question I'd like to ask you about regarding the immigrant population on Long Island. With the loss of this support, many people are in danger of losing their homes, losing their rental spaces. And some say it could be as bad as the Great Depression. As far as the folks living on Long Island, the immigrant population on Long Island, what kind of an impact is it having on their ability to stay where they're living?
Well, that's a terrific question. I mean, August 20th is when the eviction moratorium is up, as we know it, and
right,
we are very fearful of what's going to happen after August 20th, because people are trying to make their payments. They're making payments to rent and not to food. You know, they're trying to stay put where they're at because their kids are in school here, because they're doing well, because this community sort of demands their labor and wants them to be here in some regard. But right now, the housing situation is one that's already difficult on Long Island, and on Eastern Long Island, it's impossible. So the folks that do actually have places to live, they're doing everything they can to keep them. There are some support services, but they can only go to a certain level. So what we're really fearful of is that people are then shifted out of their homes. The homelessness factor during COVID, during a potential resurgence in the fall or the winter, hoping to God not, but being prepared for that, and also being prepared for the fact that this is a seasonal economy out here. So after the fall is when people usually are hunkered down, trying to live off the savings that they made throughout the summer. So they already weren't able to work as much this summer. Then we have the winter. Then we have the eviction moratorium, and then we have less work happening in the winter and the fall. We're looking at a terrific, perfect storm of a very difficult time. And I understand that this is across the country. I know this is not just specific to this area or just specific to Latino community members, but it is something that we in the East End have to make sure that we're looking at, because we are also surrounded by a tremendous amount of luxury and tremendous amount of good fortune. And there needs to be ways that we sort of activate that good fortune to make sure that this region is taken care of at a greater degree.
I mentioned the $600 a week compensation benefit coming from the federal government through the states for people who were out of work. Being seasonal workers, were members of this immigrant community, the folks who do depend on summer work, which didn't happen this year, were they able to take much advantage of that benefit?
Some were able to take that advantage, and some weren't. I mean, the majority weren't. We have folks that are working in a gamut of industries out here, from cleaning to landscaping to restaurants to also their own business, owning their own businesses as well, and those businesses being so affected by COVID. You know, some of them were able to apply for PPP, but not most of them. And so there are a number of ways that some of the benefits just don't trickle out here on the East End.
What can be done to improve the situation for the community, do you think, at least in the short term?
Well, I think I have to look at what is the beauty of this region. I mean, we are very lucky to have a number of volunteers and a number of philanthropic initiatives that we that's how we run. OLA is mainly funded by this private funding. And so I look at that and I don't want to put necessarily a lot more pressure on that, but I still look around me and see there's enough here that we can take care of our own. And that means the East End needs to have the ability, whether it be town by town. We've got 5 different towns out here. We've got 10 different police forces. We're very specialized. We have our little silos and our little bubbles. But that can work to our advantage in a situation like this. We can make sure that everyone in each of our towns and each of our villages that has access so that their lives are not fully pulled apart by this pandemic. And I think that we can do it out here in a way that maybe it's even harder to do other places. But because I'm based out here and because this is the work that I'm doing, I see that as something that maybe we can do, and we can do it well. And I don't want to sit back and feel as though that all is lost. I don't think so. This is an amazing region. It's a resilient region with resilient people, Latino and non. And I think we can come together and make something work out here in a way that maybe could be a model for other places. But I believe in this region, and we are going to try to do everything we can to make it work.
How thin have your resources been stretched at OLA in order to get done, and it sounds like a lot, what you've been doing?
Yes, they're pretty thin. We were able, though, to hire a crisis coordinator because we found ourselves focused about 80% on crisis response and recovery, which is where we want to kind of aim this at the recovery side as well. So we were able to do that as sort of not a permanent position, but we have a total of 6 people that work in this organization. That's it. We rely very much so on the volunteer organizations, other partnerships that we have out here, like CME and like Temple Adas Israel and other partnerships. We rely heavily on that, but our resources are extremely thin because we want to keep this going, and the viability of OLA is so important for a myriad of reasons that don't have to do with COVID. You know, we were established in 2002 because of the lack of equity and the lack of access to sort of basic human needs out here for members of our community. And that we were formed in 2002. I joined as a full-time executive director in 2016, and those needs and a whole other area has sort of opened up that we have to be addressing. So we already had a lot to address beforehand. So we are very stretched thin, but we're also thankful for the support that we do get. But we need to build that. We need to make sure this is something that's here for the long term, because this recovery is years and years from now. And we need to be dedicated to it, and we will be.
Ms. Perez, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Minerva Perez is the executive director of OLA on Eastern Long Island. Many people who have lost their jobs or at least some income during the pandemic shutdown could be in danger of losing their homes, too. The governors of both Connecticut and New York issued executive orders to keep renters and homeowners sheltered during the height of the pandemic. But these grace periods will end, and the extra $600 federal dollars a week benefit for unemployed people goes away next week, too. That could leave renters vulnerable to eviction and homeowners to foreclosure. With me on the phone is Ian Wilder. He's the executive director for Long Island Housing Services. It's a private nonprofit fair housing advocacy and enforcement agency. It serves Suffolk and Nassau County. Welcome, Mr. Wilder.
Hello. How are you today?
Pretty well, pretty well. How about you?
I'm doing good. Thank you.
Good. Could you tell us first, what kind of help does your organization provide?
We're an over 50-year-old civil rights organization focusing on fair housing. And as part of that work, we also provide housing counseling services for tenants and for homeowners facing foreclosure. We also do provide some legal services for those homeowners who are having an issue.
Governor Cuomo extended the hold on evictions to, I believe, August 20th. I'm wondering, what should renters be doing now? What do they need now to prepare for that deadline?
Sure. Yeah, the problem with that extension, obviously, is that when it's over, and the extension is actually a little more complicated, but in essence, let's talk about for that date. They need to start making calls to figure out a plan. What's going to happen when these, in essence, moratorium end? Because they're going to be owing all of that rent unless some other program steps in. So it would be a good idea for them to talk to housing counseling agencies such as mine, for them to reach out to any community organizations that they have ties with to see if they have funds available. New York State has some funds available to help renters through homes and community renewal. So they should start making plans for how they're going to handle the situation when the moratorium is lifted.
Do you know how many people are facing eviction on Long Island right now?
I haven't seen numbers, but we are frightened at the possibilities. I mean, based on the high unemployment numbers we see every week, that translates into people not being able to pay a mortgage or rent, most likely.
Interesting. You say you're frightened at the possibilities. How does what's happening right now in terms of people potentially finding themselves in eviction situations, how does it compare with, I hesitate to use the word, but with normal times?
With normal times, it doesn't compare. These are abnormal times. I would look more back at the crisis of 2008, 2009, and our fear is that it would be worse than that because that was initially a mortgage problem, which became an economy problem, which then became a problem for renters who lost their jobs to the economy. This is an economic problem which affects both homeowners and renters at the same time. So once the moratorium are lifted, we're going to have a much larger problem. I fear it will be larger than even the last crisis.
I have heard some predictions that, and this would apply to the country as a whole, but as these federal programs, including the $600 a week, as these programs and state programs end, the homelessness situation could reach depression-level numbers. Are you in that same way of thinking?
Yes, I think that is a possibility. We expect it to be a crisis of historic levels. We are bracing ourselves for being able to provide as much help as possible. Right now, the level of calls to us, though we've seen some increase back and forth, has not been overwhelming because the stopgap measures that the federal and state government have put in place have been allowing people, as you've said, to continue to shelter in place. When those measures end, we expect floodgates to open.
And what about extending the grace periods for both rents and mortgages? Is there a push for that at all? What do you think the odds might be for that happening?
I've seen some push for that, but I think what we need more push for is what happens when that ends. Because at some point, a grace period ends. So in my world, we need to plan for what we do when a grace period ends, whatever that grace period is. I mean, I've seen a lot more movements for such as cancel rent or so on and so forth, which are dealing with what happens when the grace period ends. I think whether the grace period is extended really should be a function of what plans we have for when it ends and when we can put those plans in place, rather than and extending the grace period being the solution. It should be a tool for the ultimate solution of helping renters and homeowners.
Do you think the pandemic has changed the way that we think about housing, the way we think about shelter, be it homeownership or rentals? Do we need to rethink policies that are meant to help people keep people in their homes?
I think the problem is the word we. Those of us in the nonprofit world have always known that we're in a crisis situation on Long Island, and the way we keep people in our homes is frighteningly fragile. We especially see that every day. We saw that through the last foreclosure crisis. I think it has provided more of a general public awareness of it, which I think might open up the space for long-term solutions for how we deal with housing. So I think in some ways the answer to your question is yes. It's opened up the path for improving our system, or as the Declaration of Independence, I believe, said, a more perfect union.
Mr. Wilder, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ian Wilder is the Executive Director of Long Island Housing Services. Our focus today is how household economies have been affected by the COVID-19 shutdown in Connecticut and New York. Consistent access to food became an immediate need for some families as schools that provided meals for kids closed and breadwinners lost their jobs in the economic shutdown. Long Island Cares is among the many food banks that stepped up to help. Paul Pachter is the CEO, and he's on the phone. Mr. Pachter, hi, how are you?
I'm very good. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you very much. Could you tell me, how does Long Island Cares work? How do you reach people who need food?
Well, you know, we've been doing what we're doing for 40 years now. This actually is our 40th anniversary. So Long Island Cares is pretty well known, certainly in Nassau and Suffolk County. We provide emergency food for 370 community-based organizations. So we're talking about the food pantries, the soup kitchens, the senior daycare programs, Head Start programs, et cetera. And, you know, so people know we're here. We're very, very visible in terms of the media's coverage of our work over the years, and certainly more specifically in the last 4 months because of COVID-19. But, you know, between our website, between the advertising that we do, the stories that are written about us, most people seem to have no problem finding us.
I mentioned that kids who lost school meals and people who lost jobs, they're examples of folks who found themselves living with food insecurity. What does that mean? What does food insecurity really mean?
Well, what food insecurity means is that an individual or a family doesn't have the resources to access 3 healthy meals per day. When you speak about children, those that receive the free or reduced breakfast or lunch program get that in their schools. And so the only meal they have to be concerned about after that is dinner. But there are other people that, you know, may just be eating one meal a day or 2 meals a day and probably not the healthiest of food because you can't sustain yourself on going to a restaurant and ordering off the dollar menu. You know, it's nice that it's there and it's good every now and then, but it's not in the long run. You can't eat that every day. So that is where food banks step in providing nutritious food to the various programs, the pantries, making it available to the public, you know, to access. So that's what we do. That's what food insecurity means. And as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic and all the shutdowns and the self-isolation and the loss of employment, we are seeing right now about a 40% increase in the number of Long Islanders who are turning to Long Island Cares for emergency food assistance.
And what approximately is that in actual numbers?
Well, in actual numbers for us right now at Long Island Cares, I can tell you that between March and the end of June, We have provided support for almost 100,000 people.
Wow.
We operate six satellite programs throughout Nassau and Suffolk where we provide our own emergency food pantries. And during the time period of March through the end of June, we assisted 41,000 people who came to the satellite programs. The bigger number that we're trying to, you know, come to terms with every day is the number of people that have never been to a food pantry before. And because of the impact of COVID-19, are turning to these 25 locations that Long Island Cares distributes food boxes from now. And that number is 59,349. So when you put those two numbers together that I just shared with you, half, almost 60%, are people that have never, you know, experienced food insecurity before, but they've lost their job temporarily or permanently. They've gone to a supermarket and can't find everything that they need. They're out of baby diapers. They're out of formula. And so they're turning to the Emergency Food Network to access this kind of support.
How did you find the resources to meet this incredibly growing need, this need that grew incredibly quickly? I wouldn't imagine that a worst-case scenario like this would have been in your plans, or was it? How do you meet this kind of a demand?
Well, we're able to meet the demand mostly because people have found us. We have 26 locations where people can come any day of the week and pick up food. Right behind the medical workers and law enforcement, all of a sudden, food banks became one of the more essential services. And Long Islanders, people across the country, have been extremely generous. The corporate sector, the foundation, the philanthropic foundations, and just the general public in donating to their local food bank. Those in the past that participated by donating food to a food drive are now donating cash. And so I think what we're seeing across the country, and certainly here on Long Island, is that the pantries and the soup kitchens and the food banks are bringing in significant donations right now, and that will sustain us. For us, our plan is to continue to do what we're doing right now with the 26 locations through the end of the year, gradually working with our member agencies to get them back to where they were. What we do know is that we are distributing more than an increase of about 46% more food into the network. And hopefully this is going to be able to carry us through to the end of the year. We're optimistic that it can be done.
Where can people go to get help, and where can people go to help you?
Well, if people need help, if they need emergency food support, they can certainly call us at 631-582-FOOD, or they can log on to our website at licares.org and click on the food locator. All they have to do is put in their zip code, and they will find all the resources that are available in their local community. And, if people want to work with us and volunteer and help out at any of the locations, including the two food box locations where we pack the boxes, there's one in Nassau, one in Suffolk, they can do that by logging onto our website as well and clicking on the link to volunteer. And if people want to support Long Island Cares with a donation, they can do the same at our website and just clicking on the donate link.
Mr. Pachter, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for reaching out to me. I enjoy it.
Paul Pachter is the CEO of Long Island Cares. And how are people managing housing and food insecurity in Connecticut, especially those unequally affected by problems wrought by the pandemic in health and finance? Camille Seabury has some insights about that. She's the Senior Research Associate with Data Haven in New Haven. And Ms. Seabury joins us via Skype. Hello.
Hi.
Data Haven collects information on well-being, equity, and quality of life in Connecticut. You have a page on your website with data that's related to the impact of COVID-19. And I'm wondering, could you tell us how it's organized? What's the focus?
Yeah, so that was actually a request of New Haven City Hall. They came to us pretty early on and said, basically, we're trying to figure out what's going on here and what these basic numbers look like to be able to start informing how they wanted to handle things, what information people might need. Yeah, that was in probably late March, early April. So since then, we started building up basically just whatever data was available from the State of Connecticut was putting on its open data portal, just kind of pulling all of that out and figuring out initially cases at, you know, state level, county level, what towns were starting to see outbreaks, what were the rates, so you can actually compare towns of different sizes rather than just case numbers. Mm-hmm. And then more data started coming out about deaths occurring, so then there was data on deaths, and then there were enough numbers to be also recording age and race. So then we were, you know, able to start comparing some of those rates. Like one of the things that we added later on was the change in the number of hospitalizations day to day, because, you know, that became one of the ways that the governor was talking about reopening in terms of like declining hospitalization numbers. So that became something that we added on.
And speaking about the disparities in, for instance, the rates of death among the different groups, do you have some specific numbers that could illustrate that for us?
Yeah, so what we're seeing most recently, so as of the 22nd, the overall death rate in Connecticut was 9.1 deaths per 10,000 residents. For Latinos, that was 12.1. For Black residents, 19.7. For White residents, 7.4. And for Asian residents, about 4. So it is really between Black residents and White residents, the rate for Black residents is more than two times as high as for White residents.
What about access, consistent access to good food, food insecurity, essentially? Do you have some specific data about that and disparities when it comes to that issue?
Yes. Having experienced food insecurity at some point in the previous year is one of the questions that we ask on our community well-being survey that is done every 3 years. So the most recent survey was in 2018. Yeah, with that, we see of adults, we see 10% of White adults have experienced food insecurity at some point in the past year. So that's where they said that they at least once didn't have enough money to provide food for themselves or their family. 23% for Black adults and 28% for Latino adults. And so then in the context of COVID-19, for food insecurity, we're seeing about 10% of adults overall in Connecticut, but then 6% of White adults, and then 18 each of Black and Latino adults.
That would naturally be connected with the loss of income as well.
Yeah.
Do you have some specific data on that again? That would give us a sort of a picture of the disparities. Who is losing income at a faster and percentage-wise larger rate?
Loss of income was, and this is, again, in the context of COVID-19. So since March 13th, 43% of White adults said that they had somebody in their household had a loss of income, of work-related income. 48% of Black adults and 62% of Latino adults.
There's a lot of information, a lot of data to digest on the website. Do you think that this information about COVID-19, this data connected with COVID-19, could change the way we think about issues of well-being?
I hope so. I do hope so. That's kind of always our goal is, you know, our role is find the data that exists, put it together, analyze it, package it up into ways that people can do things to make changes in their communities, better their communities, advocate for their communities.
Ms. Seabury, thanks so much for your time and the information today. We appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
Camille Seabury is the Senior Research Associate with Data Haven in New Haven, Connecticut. That's it for the program today. Produced by Fatou Sangari and Senior Producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.